chances, Gary O'Neill to win it.
They've got it. Terrific header. Callum Robinson. Super ball in.
Great feeling. We have to treasure these nights.
Well, hello again. This is the RTÉ Soccer Podcast. I'm Adrian Eames. James O'Toole from Soccer Republic is also with us on the line and bringing some midfield class to the studio. The man himself, Paul Corry, is with us. James, first of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Adrian?
Good. Yeah, not too bad.
The sun is out today, which is always good.
Yeah, yeah. Although, James, you see, this is a podcast and you're saying the sun is out and then somebody downloads it on a Sunday morning and it's lashing rain and you've just shattered the whole thing.
Well, they could download it in 5 minutes' time and it'd be lashing rain as well. So.
Anyway, you got your fixtures. You're waiting like a kid before Christmas for the fixtures to come out. And then they came out and it was about, oh, okay.
They were the exact same as what I said last week, weren't they?
Yeah.
As I said, I couldn't see them changing that series of fixtures anyway. It's interesting to see them over the 3 days. I think hopefully that gets a lot of people who wouldn't normally watch League of Ireland watching League of Ireland, because as we know, the Premiership is about to finish in what, a week and a half's time.
Well, Paul Corry is with us in studio, socially distant, as is the norm nowadays, Paul. But I guess in your playing days, you were always that little bit off your man, weren't you? Anyway, you were good at keeping distance.
With or without the ball. I was probably a bit off the man trying to chase them too, Adrian. I wasn't exactly quick.
Yeah. What's been your impressions of the last wee while in terms of the saga over the format? We're not going to drill down into that again, but the ongoing saga that was the format and before that, the finances. It took a while to get there, but football is on the horizon.
It is, and you know, it was a bit of a long, drawn-out process, and I would have said that in Morning Ireland about 2 weeks ago, that I thought we were in danger of actually losing public interest because we seem to be going around in circles. And even listening to the likes of Vinnie Perth, you can sense the frustration of how long it took, but we're moving on now. We have a date, we have fixtures in place, we have the FAI Cup in place as well, so we've turned a corner, at least we're getting there, and hopefully there's a positive sign of things to come.
But James, a bit of a blow for clubs with the news this week that the government is again restricting, you know, putting a limitation of 200 people in total at matches. The GA championships, club championships around the country getting underway, but limited attendance at games, and you take, you know, 200, that includes team squads, backroom officials, management, physios, you know, media and whatnot. You could be left with maybe 100 spectators. That's going to be tough now for clubs to cope with, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be tough, but even if it was the muted 500, it was going to be tough anyway. Look at squads. Well, we got 25 people per squad, maybe 30 people per squad. That gives you 60, 15 members of the media. Puts you up to what, 75? So yeah, you're talking just about 100 people in total. But listen, it was going to be a tough job to divvy out amongst season ticket holders the positions anyway. It's got a little bit tougher, but now, do you know what, even though it's tougher, it might be easier for the clubs because they're even further restricted, so it makes it easier for them to say, well, we've tried our best, we're sorry, we'll do a lottery and we'll get fellas in to watch the games.
Okay, all right. Listen, coming up on the podcast, we'll be chatting to the Shelburne manager, Ian Morris, also chatting referees. How are they fixed for the resumption of football? We'll take a trip across the water. A lot of goings on over the last couple of days with Leeds being promoted from the Championship as champions and Liverpool gearing up to be presented with the Premier League trophy, ending that long, long wait. But first, let's start with the FAI and news from last week of some of the appointments. And I guess the key one is Mark Scanlon is the new League of Ireland director and moves from his current job as national coordinator for schools and third level university football. We're joined by Paul Lennon of the Irish Daily Star. How are you doing, Paul?
How are you doing, lad?
Good. No, not too bad. Now, yeah, you've been writing about football for so many years now. How many years have you written?
Oh, good grief. It's 30 in the national level and before that in Drogheda and Navan before that. So a long time. I can remember back to the good old 70s, would you believe?
Yeah.
So it's great. And even though I love myself and some of my colleagues and fellows from Yes players and managers of yesteryear, we love going down memory lane. But I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that I think today we have superior ground, superior pitches, players who are, I think, technically better than they were a few decades ago. They're undoubtedly fitter. It's a younger league than they used to be. And we you can't hide the blemishes that the League of Ireland has, and if you can't turn a blind eye to the problems. But there's a lot of really good stuff going on. There's a lot of good coaches. It's a young league, which is, I think, is always great to see that young players get their chance. And I can't wait now for football to return. Hopefully now the off-pitch shenanigans of the last while, which was probably inevitable given the really big problems over finance and the problems over getting the restrictions and when we could actually get back to playing football. And the rigmarole, and Paul and James are right, it went round the house as far too long. But we're there now, and I think there could be a lot of positivity. It could be a real kind of like sprint of a league in contrast to a marathon. So, but I'm really looking forward to that. I think it'll be a really exciting few months.
And what about those appointments that I mentioned? Mark Scanlon, the new League of Ireland director. We'll come on to some of the other ones. Rae Walsh retaining her position. Mark Scanlon, first of all, perhaps not a huge amount known amongst the wider footballing public about him. What do you think of that appointment?
It's an interesting one because he's very well regarded in the FAI when it comes to the development of universities football, and that's an area that has grown incredibly in the last decade. There are now any given season, if you look at the League of Ireland and cut across under 17, under 19, and first teams, the number of players who have come through the colleges football grows exponentially every year. And a lot of clubs have links now with third level colleges, St. Pat's, with Maynooth, for an example, and that works really well. So Mark was involved in that. The games themselves, the leagues themselves in third level have grown. There are far more players playing it now. So he's been involved in that, as have a lot of other good people as well in the colleges and in the committee, etc. But making that step from there to the League of Ireland surprised people, because a lot of clubs, and there is puzzlement among some of the bigger clubs as to why the FAI didn't hold a recruitment process that looked within the FAI and outside the FAI, and maybe bring in a person who greatly experienced of league football, of professional sporting, of sport, maybe from England, maybe from elsewhere in this country. And that's where there has been some puzzlement among some of the clubs, not against Mark per se, not because of the doubts about his capability or his ability, but because he doesn't come from a professional sporting background.
Paul, Vinnie Perth was on the podcast here last week, and he raised that very point. Why not advertise the position externally as well as internally? Would you agree with Vinnie's assessment?
Yeah, and also echo what Paul has just raised there in regards to this completely different ball game with regards to running what is a professional league. What the league is crying out for is sponsors to come in. It's to commercialise the league. It's to generate different lines of revenue. And that is an extremely difficult job given what's gone on in the league in the last number of years and how difficult that has been and how far we are with regards to our facilities and our stadiums in particular. So it's a massive, massive job. And personally, and like Paul said there, it's nothing against Mark Scanlon, because the feedback is that he's a great executor of ideas. But I would have rather probably somebody with a bit of a more commercial experience to come in and take that role and to really give guidance and to take the lead on driving the league forward and bringing new sponsors and bringing new faces into our league, because that's what we need. And for Mark, it's a very, very difficult role to take on. And I hope that maybe that there's somebody above him who's going to guide him strategically with regards to how we drive it forward. And then maybe Mark is the executor of those ideas. But like Vinnie Perth would have said, I probably would have rather somebody externally outside of the FAI, somebody who's done it potentially across Europe previously before, who has done it with a league that's similar size to our own and taken it forward. But they've put their faith in Mark Scanlon, and I guess there's a lot of people in the League of Ireland who are going to put their faith in Mark as well, because we do need change and we need to see it sooner rather than later.
And Paul, a lot of people were in the last wee while going down the route that it was going to be Niall Quinn who would take on the role, but that didn't come to pass. Why do you think Niall wasn't enticed into going for the job?
I think he was at the cold face for the last few months when it came to sorting out the finance for resuming the league, at the cold face for the streaming project, which is now about to be announced and will be announced this week, and was at the cold face of a lot of difficult meetings with the clubs. And I just think, I'm just wondering from his point of view, did he say to himself, does he want to commit himself to, because this the next few years are critical to the development of the league. I suppose you could say that they always are. But I think Mark and whoever comes in with Mark, you could have to give this a good 3, 4, 5 years of your time. It's going to be constant. You won't get much time off. It's a really big commitment because the clubs now demand that. A lot of the clubs are very well run. Okay, they've had some of them have had the problems, but there's quite a good professional setup in a lot of clubs, and even the clubs that are semi-professional are quite well run also. And again, I'm not trying to hide that there are problems at times. Of course, there are. So we have Gareth Keller at St Patrick's Athletic, the owner, making strong demands recently. Bill Hulsizer, the American, whose family and companies owned Dundalk, again making very strong demands, and that's reflected and echoed in other clubs. So they'll be expecting Mark to deliver, and I think Niall probably sees himself more in maybe using a floating role within the FEI, be it as future deputy CEO or in some other senior role in the organisation, because his role, his current interim role expires soon, as does Gary Owens, who is the interim CEO, interim deputy CEO, there's so many titles. So maybe he sees himself doing something else. Maybe he didn't want to be pigeonholed in just on league football.
Paul's almost. Quick one though, this director role, obviously because it was an internal role, we haven't seen, or I don't know if you've seen, a job spec. So do we think the commercial area is going to fall onto Mark Scanlon, or do we think, let's get these clubs together, let's get everybody pulling in the right direction, that side of the League of Ireland is going to fall onto him, and somebody else will be there with him for that commercial area, for strengthening support with sponsors, with league sponsors, getting a league name and stuff like that? Do you think that's the way this is going to work?
I think they'll bring in expertise from other people in the. I think the commercial end will fall to somebody else. And Mark Russell's in there at the moment. He's on the commercial portfolio. So presumably him, or maybe somebody along with him, will look after the league. Because you're right, James. We need to develop the league in so many areas, and definitely commercially, sponsorship wise. There's some very good sponsors at the moment. There's a lot of good money going in, but it needs to be expanded. It probably needs to be updated. SSC, electricity, this is the final year. So the scope and to bring in new companies, the scope maybe to expand and bring in more money, and also work with TV companies and the whole internet area, and realise more money, because there's one area that we need to do. We need to bring in more money centrally to the league. The clubs, in many cases, are probably exploiting the resources as much as they can to various levels. We need a bigger pot of money centrally to distribute to the clubs in prize money and in basic grants and basic funding every year.
And James, just on that as well, you know, you mentioned about everybody pulling in the same direction. And I actually think that we're at a stage now where that's actually impossible. And you look at what has gone on over the last number of weeks and how long it took us to come to a decision whereby we're actually pretty much in the same format of the league and the same format of the FAI Cup, albeit there won't be as many teams. But what that has shown to me is that we cannot get everybody pulling in the same direction. And unfortunately, what we're going to have to do is we need somebody, well, that's Mark Scanlon, to make bold decisions for the greater good of the game, because there's too many people and there's too many clubs and there's too many boards and too many councils that are looking after their own needs. And what we need is we need somebody to come in, and like Rude Doctor did with the underage system, with the national leagues, the schoolboy teams unfortunately had to miss out. There's going to have to be people at different points of the process that are going to have to move out of the way, and they're just going to have to accept that what's for the greater good of football is not for the greater good of themselves. So I actually think that we need somebody who's going to drive this and who's going to be a bit more ruthless with the different parties around the table, because what has shown in the last number of weeks and the last number of months and years is that the current format of trying to get everybody pulling in the same direction just does not work.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we need people pulling in the right direction. And the one way to look at this, the main one really, is if we look at what we're all looking at the moment, we're looking at the Premiership in England. When that initially came about, when that idea came about, clubs were unhappy. Some clubs weren't in the top 28, I think it was initially. Some clubs were left out. But every club realised that if we get on this and we work together, this is going to be a funding model that's going to work for every club in the Premiership, Championship, League One, League Two, et cetera, et cetera, that the money drips down. I think we need that kind of thinking here where you're either with us or you're not.
Yeah.
And as you said, someone needs to be radical and go, this is where we're going, like it or lump it. If you don't like it, tough, but this should help the whole football, the umbrella all the way down, right the way down to the roots of football. If we make a bold decision now, it should help it in the future.
And Paul, some of the other appointments: Mark Russell, Commercial and Marketing Director; Ger McDermott, the new head of Grassroots, previously served as Clubs and League Development Manager. And a few eyebrows raised, perhaps, Rhea Walsh, part of the old regime, retains her role as Chief Operations Officer. That caught the attention of a lot of people. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that was very interesting because Rhea was involved during the end of the Delaney era. Various roles, Chief Operations Officer. Also, she was involved in governance issues, and she's also Company Secretary. So it's an interesting appointment, and I know, again, that there are people within football in this country who raised their eyebrows when they saw that. And again, not to... To cast any aspersions on Rhea's ability, or she is a qualified and a practicing solicitor, so she has many, many talents. But to have been part of the FEI setup during that period, and now she's been reappointed, and Gary Owens, who is the interim CEO at present, made a very robust and strong defence of the decision in an interview this week. So she has the full support of Gary Owens and presumably the board as well, who ratified this appointment. But looking from the outside, all these appointments this week were all internal. And I think it would have been good to see the FEI going outside Abbottstown, the HQ, and making one or two appointments from outside.
And just a word, Paul, as well, the FEI is an organisation once again very much politically in the spotlight, with a clear message from government and indeed from John Tracy, the CEO of Sport Ireland, that there'll be no funding for the FAI until they make changes agreed in the Memorandum of Understanding. That one is simmering away, isn't it?
It is, unfortunately. You asked me how long I've been watching football, Adrian, for many decades, thankfully. Unfortunately, this ongoing saga of FAI, you know, shenanigans and political stuff off the pitch in the corridors of power is now in its next phase, sadly. And there's a growing standoff between the CEO, the interim CEO, Gary Owens, and the independent chairman of the board, Roy Barrett, and the elected members to that same board, led by Jerry McInerney, the president, vice president, Paul Cook, and also Dick Shakespeare of UCD, and others as well, has to be said. The government, politicians, Sport Ireland, the Department of Sport are all 150% or 200% behind the current chairman, Roy Barrett. But now we have people on the board who are unhappy with the Memorandum of Understanding, which includes the fact that later this year they want the number of independent directors on the board to go from 4 to 6. That would be half the members of the board, with the independent chairman, Roy Barrett, having a casting vote if there's a tie, 6-6. That would leave potentially outside people, nothing to do with football, with power, which I find strange. We've gone from one extreme to the other of the Delaney era to the opposite, which to me isn't the right outcome either. There is a happy medium in the middle, and what we're looking towards and what the government's trying to force through and what Sport Ireland's trying to force through, to me, doesn't look like the solution to the problems we had a few years ago. And now, as a kind of a third force, the larger council, which 79 people, which covers every junior league, covers different affiliates and people from all over the country, etc., and all the divisional associations, they now want an emergency meeting to discuss, an emergency council meeting to discuss this in the next few weeks. That's going to happen because they have enough people to look for it. So that's going to be the next battleground. And unfortunately, Adrian, we're now into, you know, year 25 of this, which, you know, that in itself is an indictment of what's going on in Irish football. It's now 24 years since we had the Night of the Long Knives, where a coup happened in the Westbury against officers of the FBI, yet a quarter of a century later, we're still at this. And sadly, I think this is going to rumble on for weeks and months and maybe longer, because there's a collision course. These two sides are on a collision course, and I don't see a way out of it unless somebody emerges from nearly outside and comes in as an arbitrator and can solve this, because it's very serious again. And sadly, here we go again.
Okay, Paul, before we let you go, as we know, Jack's funeral, big Jack Charlton's funeral, takes place on Tuesday. You mentioned you've been covering football for a few decades. You didn't say how many decades, by the way.
We'll leave that
hanging.
I remember seeing the great Sligo Rovers team in 77.
Okay, that was a great team. But Jack Charlton, because you would have soldiered on many a foreign field as a reporter. Your memories of the man, I'm sure you have a story or two to tell, have you?
Just one or two. It was just on the football front. He was, there's been so many things said about him. People just going on the tributes were paid to him on the Boys in Green last weekend, and little clips on YouTube and elsewhere. You get just watch him analyse a game or analyse a team or a performance, and not always Ireland. Look at some of the other stuff he did. His ability to analyse and make quick, concise, evaluations of teams and players was really good. Like, I mean, Backy Bonner was one of our heroes when we beat England 1-0 in Stuttgart, the game that probably signalled the real start of where we were going as a football, senior football nation. Yet after the game, he had a go at Packy because Packy wasn't coming off his line early enough. He could be very blunt. I remember being in the post-match press conference where we drew 0-0 against Liechtenstein, and that signaled the real end of the Jack era. 6 months later, he was gone. And he blew his top over. He said, this will hurt us. Even though we had to play Austria twice in big games, he said, we're after drawing against and the minnows of the minnows, and said, this will really hurt us. His perception was astounding. One little person, when I remember, you'd be out with, if you were in his company and you were with the senior guys who were there at my time, they would have been Charlie Stewart, Peter Byrne, the late Noel Dunn, great, your colleague Gabriel Egan. And he was with those, he trusted you, because if he saw you with them, he trusted you he could give you tidbits of information. And he would give you little bits and steers on why players weren't playing up where certain players are in certain positions. One lovely one was when we were in Orlando in 1994 during the World Cup, before the first ball was kicked, we were there for about 13 days. It was a long haul into the first game. And he invited me and four or five other journalists up to his suite so we could have a quiz in his room. And he had set up a keg of Guinness in his room, and Jack acted as barman, quiz master, and he then started answering questions. It was bizarre. He was the manager on the football team, very, very relaxed, very at home, quite happy to mingle with the media, and he trusted you not to say anything, repeat anything that was off the record. He got steers from. So he was blunt, but he was also very helpful. And, I came in at the end of the last 4 or 5 years of his reign, and it was an eye-opener as to how football operated at the top level, because he played at the top level, he'd managed at the top level, and now he was being a success at the top level. So it was a great insight on him, something I was always very privileged and still feel privileged that I was there to witness it and observe at close quarters.
OK, well, listen, that's nicely put. Many thanks for joining us on the RTÉ Soccer Podcast. That's Paul Lennon of the Irish Daily Star. And, of course, Jack's funeral taking place on Tuesday. And the FAI encouraging fans on the day to wear green, and stations around the country, if they can or if they wish to, can play Put 'Em Under Pressure at 12:30 on the day. But let's move on. As we all know, football returning here in Ireland on the 31st of July. Shelburne back in action on the first day of August, taking on Waterford, 2:00 start on the 1st of August. That's a Saturday. Ian Morris, the Shelburne boss, is with us. And Ian, I bet at this stage you can't wait to get it all started once again.
Yeah, can't wait. It's been a long time coming. We've been back now a few weeks, and we've been just come back off today, a double header of games last night and today, and then we'll bounce into a double header next week to lead us into Waterford on the first. So the boys are looking fresh, they're looking strong, and just eager to get going, really.
Yeah. How did you manage and how did you cope with the dark days of the lockdown? How did you occupy yourself?
I spent time with my family, which was brilliant. I suppose people say, "Oh, was it tough for you?" And the answer for me was no, because the stress for me is trying to pick a team and to try win matches. And when you've not got that hanging over you every week, well, then things tend to become a little bit lighter, and you get to spend a lot more time with the family. So yeah. It wasn't all doom and gloom for me.
Did you keep in regular contact with your players?
Yes, we were 5 days at least, whether it was on Zoom strength and conditioning classes, whether we were doing tactical stuff, we were doing some mental well-being classes. So we were quite busy. The players loved it. They did not want to stop. They wanted to keep going. And to be fair, we've reaped the rewards since they've come back in, because everyone has tested stronger, they tested fitter. And we're in a better place as a squad.
So you're happy that the players will be up to speed, that you've had enough time to get up to speed for the 1st of August?
Absolutely. I think we've prepared really as best as we can. But that's the thing, is with football, you can prepare as well as you possibly can, but within the 90 minutes of a game, anything can happen. So it's about being really diligent in our work on the opposition and making sure we're set. But in terms of the fitness wise, in terms of sharpness, we're in a good place.
And Ian, you obviously got off to a good start to the season as well, and like, you were unfortunate to lose at home to Dundalk. I think it's what Waterford first up, so you'd hopefully your home form just continues on a bit.
Absolutely. I'm still a little bit disappointed with our start, to be honest with you. I thought the goals that we've given away in both the Dundalk and the Bowes games were really, really poor. From set pieces, which we work on consistently, and just being poor in our defensive half or in our own box as well. So for that, for me, I think we gave easy goals away, which could have been very, very preventable, and we would have been in a lot better place. But I suppose you can't complain with 2 wins out of 4 games at the beginning. I just want more. I want us to be better. I feel we can be better. So we're really going to be coming out and attacking teams and being really, really clinical, hopefully, in the way we approach games.
Has the goals changed at all, Ian, based on that? You know, obviously you've seen how your players and your team has fared so far. Has the initial goal from the start of the season now changed?
No, I've been quite open with that. I want to win things. I want to challenge. I want to get after it. Everything we do, I want to finish as high up the table as we possibly can. I read a couple of bits and I've listened to a couple of bits and talk. It's only half a season, but for me, that mentality is not right. It's a season. It's a competitive league. It's a competitive cup. You want to win it. There's no, for me, there's no step off. There's no foot off the pedal. It's only 14 games. We're going full throttle. We're going to go after every team. We're going to try to win every game and hopefully do well in the cup as well. So the goal hasn't changed. I think we really need to be focused and really need to be determined and be a horrible team to play against. But we've also got a lot of quality within the squad.
And Ian, can I just ask you about the prospect of, you know, playing in front of limited crowds? Like, you know, they're talking about 200 capacity in total, and that includes everybody, management, squads, the works. So 200, maybe 100 spectators, whatever it might be. But in that kind of atmosphere, getting players revved up, and you mentioned the word there, focused, is that going to be a challenge, do you think?
Quite possibly, but then again, we're looking at it now. We'll have 7-8 games now in our lead up before we play Waterford. So they've been in the same kind of capacity, whether they're behind closed doors or not. So players will have gotten used to it now, that they would have had to deal with it and they would have had to get the drive. I think it's like anything, pre-season friendlies or friendly games, you can come off a little bit, but everything's going to start ramp up now. The media coverage, the streaming, I suppose, would have been live on telly. Players will know these things. They'll know what's going on. They'll know people are watching. So it's just that's been quite a lot of the work we've been doing with our mental well-being classes, with our mental strength classes, just getting our mindset on what we're trying to do and what we're trying to achieve. And we collect our data from our GPS, and the lads are covering good distance. They're moving really well. So in terms of how our output is going, in terms of physical, it's been good. And then our tactical side of things is improving. We've still got a lot we want to work on. But it's been impressive so far, and the lads are in a good place.
And Ian, as a manager, the fact now that when football returns that you'll be permitted to use 5 substitutes, How is that going to change the dynamics of football and coaching from a managerial perspective?
I love it. It's something I like. I like to have options. I like to have the ability to try and change the game. So for me, I'd welcome it. You can't say you can change the whole outlook of your team, but that's what substitutes are for. You make subs to try and make an impact or to try short things up at the other end. If that's the way the game is going, you want players to come on and light it up. So some players can be, if you've got a lot of pace and you're bringing someone on late in the game against a fullback who's going to play the full one, that's fatigue. And they're the options you want as a manager. So for me, I'd welcome it. It gives me the opportunity to have more options to change the game.
What do you think, Paul? Because a lot of people look at it and they say five changes, that's going to favour the stronger teams or the teams that have a great depth of squad.
Yeah, I think that is the case, and it's probably more the case when you look at the Premier League and you see the riches that are available there. But maybe where the differences in quality aren't as great within our own league, it's going to put a couple of managers to the test and see what sort of tactical changes they can make and see how they can change up games. And I think Ian's made a really good point there that if you've got lagging fullbacks or lagging centre-halves and you've got people who can come on with a bit of pace and change games, there's the potential there to really liven things up. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it fares out. It'll be interesting to see whether or not we might see some younger players who are on the bench actually get a game or get some minutes under their belt, and we might get to see some new faces. So quite interesting in that case.
All of this, Ian, because, of course, players are just coming back to fitness, so they're permitting five substitutes in matches. But do you think that's something that's going to stay, that's going to remain?
Quite possibly. If there's no negative feedback, I don't see why they would change it. It gives that option, and if games become a lot livelier and there is significant changes in the tempo of the game because of the substitutes, that might be a positive, but only time will tell on that, really.
Yeah. And finally, before we let you go, just a word on that Waterford game, your first matchup on the 1st of August. That's a bit of a tricky one now because obviously Waterford have a new manager in John Sheridan. We have to wait and see if he's going to bring in a few players. So could be a difficult enough one.
Yeah, it'd be a tough game. John actually signed me twice as a player. We won League Two at Chesterfield together. So I know John quite well. Fantastic man, fantastic manager. So he's a tough man as well. So he'll have his side set up right, and he'll have them set up well, and it'll be a decent game. They look like they're going to start bringing in players, whether it is from the English market or whether it is from the loan market. That could be interesting because they'll have to isolate. So that there could be a lot of variables within what they're going to produce on the first day of the season. So it's a case of us doing our homework now in pre-season and seeing what they. Seeing the way they're playing and what possibly could be coming in the door for them. So it is a little bit of the unknown because there could be a few names in the door. So we just have to be diligent in our homework before the first.
Have you someone out in Dublin Airport, Ian, checking on arrivals?
Yeah. You've always got your texts and your calls and everything that you're trying to do to try to get any information you possibly can. So, yeah, I'll be very busy behind the scenes.
Yeah, also as well, Ian, you've got Waterford coming to you on the first day. You don't know what kind of squad they're going to have at all until probably 2 days beforehand. Then you're away to Sligo. Again, you don't know what kind of squad they might even have.
We've got Finn Harps in between. Our first week is monstrous. We go Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday. So the 9 points that week is absolutely massive for us. So we've got Finn Harps away at 5:45 on the Tuesday, and then we're bouncing straight in on a Saturday. So it really is it's a tough week for us. And a big week with the teams relatively in and around us. So we're fully geared and we're fully focused, and our preparation is going to have to be really good that week. And using the squad, so the five substitutes for us, is going to be a massive benefit going into them three games, because some players might not get through three games in 7 days. So squad, you're going to need every single player to be firing and available and ready to step in if called.
Okay.
With the five subs, you're going to hook anybody early?
I don't know if I'd have that in me, but look, games change a different way, and it might be a case of making that move. I certainly wouldn't step away from it.
Best of luck with it, Ian. Many thanks for joining us on the podcast. Well done. That's Ian Morris, the Shelburne manager. Paul, did you ever consider becoming a referee after you hung up the boots?
No, absolutely not.
Why not? Because you've got a great view of the game and you understand it from a player's perspective, so didn't fancy it?
No, I just think you're open to so many so many channels of almost borderline abuse from managers, from players, from fans. So definitely not one for me.
James, you're not shy or retiring. You're very assertive. I would think you're definite referee material.
I'm a qualified referee.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, me and Johnny Mack a number of years ago did the referees course as part of a piece into Soccer Republic a couple of years ago out in the FEI. We did 3 days on the course, and both myself and Johnny passed the course at the end of 3 days.
I tell you and Johnny Mack are open to a lot of abuse in a pair of referee shorts.
So did you go on and use those qualifications?
Oh, no, I was too busy. Too busy to be doing it. Like with Soccer Republic, you're there Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So there's no time to get out and actually ref any games. And a bit like Paul, my wife and my children will tell you, Adrian, I'm the type of person who has the patience of someone who has absolutely no patience. So I don't think I would be.
Yeah. You never know. You never know. Paul O'Brien, the president of the Irish Referees Society, is on the line. Paul, there's a man here waiting. He's got his whistle, he's obviously got his kit. Do the hard sell.
Oh, coming on. You know, we're desperate at this stage to get members in. So there was a shortage before COVID, and there's going to be an even bigger shortage after. So
yeah.
All our doors are open at this stage, and everyone's welcome in.
Is that the reality you're facing, that referees are dropping off the panel?
Sadly, we had a shortage of referees prior to COVID, but I don't think this is going to help us now. I'm not saying it's crisis level yet, but it is getting to the stage where we're going to have to start recruiting, and unfortunately our age dynamic dictates a lot of that, so we'd like to see, can we get a few younger people into the game to take up the whistle and get out there and do a few matches for us.
So how many referees would there be in Ireland at the various levels, from League of Ireland all the way down?
Well, I'm the president of the Irish Soccer Referees Society, so we've approximately 1,000 members, and then there's about 200 referees nationwide that wouldn't be members of the society, but they'd still referee as registered referees with the FAI. So in total, about 1,200 in the whole country.
And what kind of feedback have you been getting from referees about, you know, the new world order, the new way of things in terms of going to matches and all the protocols that are in place? Have many of them come back to you with expressing concern?
A lot of the members were anxious to get back, but obviously under the right circumstances, because you know, we're part of the game as well. We enjoy it. Not so much the abuse, but certainly the partaking in the game. But there was a lot of angst about it. But the protocol seemed to put a lot of them to rest. We're back raring to go. But just the protocols have to be adhered to by not just the referees, but everybody involved in the game. But a lot of excitement to be back, but,
yeah,
you know, mixed with a little bit of trepidation and nervousness as well.
And Paul, on match day, did the referees have the call if they go to a venue and say the protocols aren't being adhered to, or the necessary distancing isn't being implemented, or whatever it might be, if some of the protocols aren't being correctly administered, do you have the call in terms of the match going ahead then? Did the match referees on the day make that call, or is it a bigger call from somebody else?
There's kind of two aspects to this. There's the COVID officers. So there's a little bit of a question mark hanging over it at the moment, that if you arrive at a game and there's no COVID officer, should the game proceed? Now, we're waiting on the FEI directive to come back on that one, to have a directive, sorry. But from my own point of view, from the Irish Soccer Referee Society's point of view, it's a recommendation that if the COVID officer is not there to meet you, you don't stay and you don't do the game. Now, obviously, you don't just walk away there and then. A little bit of common sense goes a long way. But in terms of actually policing the social distancing and things like that, no, referees won't have a role in that. We have enough to be doing on the pitch without having to monitor what goes off the pitch. So once the protocols have been met, we will just get on with enforcing the laws of the game or applying the laws of the game. But we certainly won't be looking to see who's 2 metres apart or who's wearing a mask. But it is in our gift, I suppose I can say, that we would be reporting it, but we certainly wouldn't be policing it.
And when football is back and we see the parks full of matches and stuff like that, another issue for you guys will be, as you said, you've about 1,200 members. Will the same ref be able to do as he would normally do, a game after game after game? Or is there an issue there where the referee will have to leave as well with the players and stuff like that? Or is that even being looked at the moment?
It's not really being looked at the moment, because there's still a lot of if buts and maybes, but you know, the scoreboy leagues, look, there's always been this them and us thing, you know, but I think that has to go out the window now, and we all have to start working together. The referees are needed. Obviously, if there's no games, there's no referees required. So it's time for us all to work together. My information is that referees can stay and do matches one after the other, but likewise, they have to be spaced out a bit more, especially in schoolboy and girl football, where you could have no breaks between games. You're just doing one constantly. So they will have to start more, not just social distancing, but pushing the games out more so there's time for the other teams to leave, the referees to go through all the procedures again of sanitising, and then starting off. But again, it's all up in the air a little bit, and to wait and see to see how things pan out a little bit.
And you mentioned there a few moments ago, Paul, you know, the abuse that referees take, and, you know, everybody who goes to games will be aware of that. But has it worsened over the last few years, or has it just always been that way?
Well, I'm refereeing 26 years, so there always has been that element of abuse. But, you know, we're always focusing on the negatives at times with abuse. Some of it actually is banter as well, and we can get on with it. But thankfully, in the last year and a half, we've seen a decline in it, and not just because of COVID, obviously. But we had that serious assault in the Midlands November 12 months ago, and the FAI brought in a disciplinary control unit, which has been looking at all assaults now. And it's taken time, but it has bedded in well. They're doing their job extremely well, actually. And thankfully, we've seen a decline in assaults. I'm not sure you'll ever eradicate abuse. You know, when the red mist descends, it descends. But look, referees are patient people. Most of us are all educated. Anyone in the Irish soccer referees gets well educated in their branch meetings. We know what to expect. It's just when it goes over the top a little bit, that's when referees have to come in. But thankfully, we're well able for it.
Yeah. And you mentioned appealing for more people to come forward and become referees, and I guess that goes for men and women. You want both sexes involved in all of this. But in terms of making the appeal, what would you say to somebody to say, look, give it a try, it's worth something, it's a good pursuit? How would you sell it to them?
Well, I've always described it as having the best seat in the house looking at a game. You know, it's all right looking on it from the stands or sitting on the fence or wherever you may be. But when you're actually out in the middle of it all, in the action, there's not quite that same feeling coming off a pitch when you've had a great game, you've been involved in a great game, and, you know, you're actually buzzing for days after. You know, again, we were talking about abuse, and it always comes up when you're talking about refereeing, but there's so much more positives to refereeing and to be involved than negatives. As I say, you've the best seat in the house when it comes to being involved in the game, especially if you're a young referee coming through the ranks. You've seen the likes of Michelle O'Neill, who has gone and refereed in World Cup finals, in the Ladies World Cup final. She did the European Super Cup. So, you know, even though you can go on and progress through League of Ireland and hopefully onto the national team, you can your world your oyster when it comes to refereeing in terms of travelling and getting progressing through the grades.
Okay, well, listen, we leave it there. We wish you the very best of luck. That's Paul O'Brien, President of the Irish Referee Society. Paul Corrie is with me in studio. Paul, from your days at Sheffield Wednesday, how did you look at Leeds United across the way?
Well, that was my league debut, actually. And it was a massive Yorkshire derby. Two teams used to absolutely hate each other, but particularly going to Elland Road, it was great atmosphere, great stadium, real football people. You always find that around Yorkshire, I think. And you can always tell that it was steeped in history and that they were, if they ever did get back to the Premier League, it was going to be something huge. So not many Sheffield Wednesday fans are like me saying it, but I'm really pleased that they're back in the Premier League.
Yeah, well, Fergal Brennan, journalist based in Liverpool, joins us on the line. It's one of the big stories on the weekend. Leeds United promoted as champions to the Premier League. It's been a long time coming for Leeds fans, and as you know, Fergal, huge support in this country. It goes back to the early 70s, that team of Giles, Lorimer and all those guys, but huge Leeds United support in this country. And for a lot of fans, it's just great to see Leeds United back, one of the big clubs, the sleeping giants for so many years, and they're back in the big time. Well, what's your thoughts on Leeds making it back to the Premier League?
I think it's very deserved. They've been comfortably the best team in the Championship so far this season. Obviously, everyone's very excited to have the fans and the club back in the Premier League, and also the chance to see Marcelo Bielsa and how tactically he's going to take on the best teams in English football. But I think, obviously, as you both mentioned, having Leeds United as a club back in the Premier League, Liverpool fans, Manchester United fans, maybe slightly through gritted teeth, are actually delighted to have the to have that rivalry back and to be able to have those away days at Elland Road, because there are certain clubs that have been relegated over the years out of the Premier League that every Premier League fan thinks, I wish they were still here. I wish we could still go to that ground. And we talk, you know, it's a bit of a common term, the big club line. But Leeds United are right there. And there's no disrespect to teams that are in the Premier League or teams that have probably had more Premier League pedigree over the last few years in comparison to Leeds. But when we talk about the size of the city, the size of the club and the history of the great players that you've just mentioned and Leeds United who've played European football, they've played Champions League football, it is great to have them back. And away from the historical side of it, just the performances they're putting this season, the way Bielsa has looked to kind of tear up the rule book of Championship football, we all tend to associate it with being a bit of a slog and 46 games and you just kind of have to grind and grind. He's looked at a different way, played very enterprising football. There's young players in the team, there's local players in the team, and I think they could surprise a few people next season.
Yeah, and talk to us about Marcelo Bielsa, because people will have heard of Bielsa ball, but it's a very particular style. It's high energy, it's get at him, it's win the ball back, it's played at great pace. I mean, one of the undoings of Leeds in the last couple of years has been the fact that they literally just ran out of steam, because he demands so much of his players, not just on match day, but in training prior to matches and the build-up to games.
Yeah, and that will be the forerunner of it next season. Obviously, the games are reduced. There's 38 games in the Premier League compared to 46, but the standard is higher. The fitness levels are higher. That is what he will look to do. He normally plays with a three-man attack that will look to press full-backs, press the centre-back when they're in possession. And if they don't win the ball and immediately create a goal-scoring chance, the midfield get up so quickly behind them that you see a lot of situations this season where there'll be one defensive midfielder for an opposition side and they just get overrun because they're expecting that ball to either come from their defenders, or they're expecting if it gets lost, we'll have a second or two to win it back and reset. And that's just not the case. That they'll have two central midfielders flying past them, but in their minds, they're thinking Leeds will be set up like them. Someone will sit back. Someone will kind of be to the side. That's just not the case. They are so quick to pounce on mistakes and pressurise mistakes. And there's obviously the case that in the Premier League, less mistakes are made and you know, they won't be given the time and the space to look to press. But we've seen that if you can create a high-pressing system that works so well. I mean, let's not forget, Liverpool have just won the Premier League based on a not-too-dissimilar style. If you can press well and then use the ball effectively when you get it, you can go places in the Premier League. And he will be saying that to the players this summer. And we all know that he's a big fan of Ovidio. He watches hundreds and hundreds of games to study the opposition. He will be super prepared, and so will the players. The other 19 teams in the Premier League next season need to be aware that Leeds are essentially coming for them.
And sitting below Leeds, obviously, you've got West Brom, Brentford, Fulham. Which one of those three do you think is going to grab that second spot?
Well, that's a difficult... Again, as I say, the Championship is a bit of a minefield, particularly when it gets to the business end of the season. I think West Brom's last couple of results, same with Brentford, I've seen a little bit of nerves. In the playoff spots and the automatics, it's all about form. It's about coming in on form and kind of riding the crest of that wave. I think in terms of points, I think West Brom will probably just edge it. I think on the final day of the season, they'll get the 3 points to go through. But then in the playoffs, it's all about form. Fulham are the team in form at the minute, unbeaten in the last five. They've got a lot of Premier League experience that are still in the squad from when they got relegated last season. So I think West Brom will have enough to get the automatic. But Fulham would be my tip for the playoffs, because you want to come in red hot and prepared for those two games. I always think the team that drops down into third or finishes third, there can sometimes be a little bit of a mental block. 46 games, players are tired physically and mentally. And if you're coming up against a team that is experienced and fresh and confident, it can be very, very difficult to play against.
I mentioned at the outset there, Fergal, you're based in Liverpool. How's it been for the last wee while since Liverpool won the title? Of course, Wednesday is a big night. The club will be presented with the trophy after the game with Chelsea. Liverpool absolutely buzzing, I'm sure. The red half of Liverpool. But it's going to be slightly strange, surreal, of course, because there'll be no fans present at Anfield for the big occasion. What are the club planning to do in terms of celebrations?
Well, you're right, it has been a bit quieter. We can get into Tesco now. That wasn't the case a few days ago or a week ago. You just having to wait to go in and get a bottle of milk. The club are still going along the line of encouraging fans to stay away. I think the celebrations outside Anfield were received well by the club, but it was very much a case of, we understand we couldn't really police against that. Please don't let there be a repeat of that with the trophy a handover after the Chelsea game in midweek. I think the club are still absolutely hamstrung by the situation with regards to coronavirus guidelines and public health guidelines that are being in place at the moment. I think that they are hoping that somewhere along the line in a couple of months' time or maybe further, that there will be an opportunity for the fans to celebrate publicly. We saw that with the Champions League final last year. Liverpool fans don't do celebrations by halves. And the club know the fans want to celebrate as a group, and they want to show just that kind of release and that happiness at ending 30 years without a league title. But it is utterly impractical at the minute. So the club, as I say, are still looking at this idea of, we want you to celebrate at home. It'll be broadcast on free-to-air TV. And the club will do a lot on social media and videos. But unfortunately, obviously, Anfield is going to be empty, but the streets around the ground probably will be again, unlike the night when they won the title, because the club just cannot risk the kind of public relations disaster that would follow if there was to be another huge gathering of supporters.
And what about the Everton fans on Merseyside? How are they coping? Because the team certainly isn't coping all that well. They've been really on the slide since football resumed.
Yeah, they've been very poor. I don't think there's much to say about them. Obviously, on the back of Liverpool winning the league, that's a real kind of irk point for them. But they have been poor. Seamus Coleman's interview after the Wolves game was quite telling, where he essentially said that it wasn't good enough from quite a few of the players. Ancelotti backed what he said by essentially calling certain players out, not naming them, but saying the attitude of players, the just laziness of them on the ball, the lack of application, even when they were still in the game at 1-0 or 2-0. There is problems at Everton, and it's a big job for Ancelotti this summer. He is expected to be given quite a decent transfer budget to work with, but given the situation that they're in, given how far they've fallen below expectations, at the start of the campaign, there was whispers of them maybe being able to push for the top four and definitely being in the Europa League spots. They're nowhere near that at the minute. Clubs with smaller budgets and lower expectations are far ahead of them now. The likes of Wolves and Sheffield United, even potentially Burnley, are probably going to finish above them as it stands. So there's a lot to be done this summer for Ancelotti. I think there could be quite a few big names leaving. And that's his only real hope to get wheels under his project at the club, is to bring in players that can bring them to a new level.
And Paul, with us here in studio, Paul, I mentioned your Sheffield Wednesday background, but Sheffield United have had such a terrific season. It's just perhaps tailed off after that defeat to Leicester City. They may not make Europe. It was looking good there for a wee while, but what a tremendous season Chris Wilder and co have had, and the Irish contingent as well, of course, with John Egan and Enda Stevens and David McGoldrick.
Yeah, incredible season. I actually would have worked with Chris Wilder at Northampton, and Alan Nill is number two. And if you told me that in 2.5-3 years' time he'd be managing a club in the top half of the Premier League, I would have been very surprised. But what he's done is, and it's probably the complete opposite of what they've done at Everton, he's recruited really well, and he's got people into his system who can perform and who can do a job for him, and they're a difficult side to play against. And I think that's probably something that goes under the radar in the Premier League now. We've got an awful lot of nice players, and everybody kind of wants to conform to play the same way and play out from the back and possession-based game. But Sheffield United are, they're a difficult team to play against.
Yeah, how good was he to work under?
Yeah, he was good. He was very much a manager. He wouldn't have done a huge amount with regards to coaching and really hands-on on the training pitch. But what he did know was when to put the boot in and to really rile you up, and when to almost put your arm around the shoulder. And that goes a long, long way in today's game in regards to getting the most out of people. And you only have to look at our own there with Enda Stevens and John Egan and the levels that they've managed to hit. And these are players who were playing in the Championship and League One not too long ago. So if you're looking at those two players, that'll probably give you a good insight into what Wilder and Sheffield United are all about.
Yeah, I wouldn't say you mess around with them.
No, not at all.
Okay. All right, listen, we leave it there. Fergal Brennan, many thanks for joining us. James, before we let you go, gosh, it's like the FAI saga. Your house, is it done?
Oh, we can cook and everything now.
Yay!
I must put up a photograph. I'm not there at the moment. I'm in Carlow at the minute, but I'll have to put up a photograph. I'm actually I'm meant to be partaking in the Midlands Beer Festival at the moment, but I've put that aside to join you two on this lovely day.
And how does the Midlands Beer Festival work?
It usually takes place in Moat, in one of the bars in Moat, but they're doing it via Zoom. They've sent out, it's bizarre, they sent out a case full of beer for people who would have been at the festival from the different breweries, and the different brewers are going through each beer throughout the day. So
how many beers have you had before this podcast?
I haven't touched a single one. There is a number of beers sitting in the fridge waiting for me right now.
He's refereeing. Percy,
drink responsibly.
Go and enjoy them, James. Paul, many thanks. Until the next time. Bye-bye.